Good morning, folks. August the 27th, 2025. We're speeding to the end of August and the beginning of September with the Labor Day weekend this weekend. And the LSU Fighting Tigers will be taking on the Clemson Tigers. Number 9 LSU, number 4 Clemson, Saturday evening game, 6:30 kickoff. I believe Chris Blair will join us at 12:30. We'll break that game down. And we'll talk about the game and a few Katrina memories as well. At the beginning of the noon hour, Greg Rusevich, chairman, Louisiana Board of International Commerce. He's also chaired the Metro Crime Commission, and he was the CEO of Transoceanic Development. During Katrina, we'll talk about the challenges that not only the city faced, but shipping, the port, and others. Philip May, president and CEO of Entergy Louisiana. He's going to join us about this Public Service Commission, which has approved their plan to build new infrastructure to power Meta's $10 billion data center in Richland Parish, one of the biggest projects ever to be undertaken in the state of Louisiana, something that we ought to be very proud of. We'll talk about what it will take to power that facility. Yesterday, the President Trump, in his cabinet meeting, showed an overlay of the size of this facility, almost taking up the entire island of Manhattan. That's how big this thing is. It is huge. And at 11, we'll visit with Sheriff Joe Lapinto, the sheriff of Jefferson Parish. He will be deploying in September first responder drones. I spoke to him last week, and he was describing to me how this works. Wait till you hear how operationally this is going to work for the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. It is cutting-edge technology. It is huge, and he'll explain what it'll mean to you as homeowners, and certainly what it'll mean to those that think they're going to step into Jefferson Parish and commit some crime. It's not a rosy picture for them. At 10:30, Bo Jones, president and CEO of the Water Institute, which actually was an outgrowth in the aftermath of Katrina, will focus on the model for resilience that came out of that, and we'll spend some time with Bo Jones. You know, kind of sad news this morning. Actually, very sad news, not kind of. I mean, you know, the fact that we are dealing with the aftermath of this Roseland plant explosion, Smitty Supply, and we find out this morning that the employees are all out of job. They've all been terminated, and they're on their way. And, you know, a lot of these folks helped in the rescue efforts. Some saw what was actually happening. Some helped evacuate their area. No injuries, thankfully. No deaths, thankfully. It's just absolutely incredible. And just days later, they find themselves out on the street. This is probably a pretty good indication that they are underinsured, that they're going to have other financial difficulties. And it's going to be interesting to see where this lands up. Already lawsuits have been filed. Does not surprise me. The fact of the matter is that there's been very little information that has been given out by this company. Obviously, they are huddled up with all of their risk managers, lawyers, and otherwise, because this company is one of the biggest privately held corporations that does what they do. They have other production facilities in other states and other storage facilities in other states as well. So it's just sad for the 400-plus workers at the Roseland plant who are out of a job. Let's move to another issue. You've heard me talk about how the city of New Orleans arbitrarily, I think, and capriciously imposed a fee on the collection of the ad valorem taxes for the school board. And as a result, the New Orleans City Council, appropriately so, I think, in my humble opinion, passed an ordinance that said no more. The city cannot do that. What's interesting, what's become a kind of a bone of contention in the mayor's race, and that's why I say, you know, listen to these folks carefully, right? I don't know about you, but from my seat, following all of the issues that have come out of this debacle of an administration called the Cantrell administration, so many issues that the only people that have really been able to successfully right the ship on some of these issues, not all of them, some are still in court, right, is a New Orleans City Council. And what I find odd is that there are those trying to say that the New Orleans City Council is part of the mayhem, which I think exhibits a little bit of ignorance and is trying to play on the lack of knowledge that voters may have as to the role of the New Orleans City Council being the legislative branch, and that the mayor has all the authority and all the power. And the New Orleans City Council had found themselves in trying to be very creative in how they can address some of these anomalies to be able to take a much more proactive role and to have a chilling effect on some of the craziness of the Cantrell administration. And where that ship has been righted has pretty much been done so by the New Orleans City Council. So the court, they go into court. The administration actually has the gall to walk into court on a restraining order hearing and admit that they were purposefully violating the ordinance that was passed in April, barring them from collecting the fees, which can cost the school system up to $6 million. They actually went in and said, right, we don't care about that ordinance. We don't care about the legislative branch. We don't care about any of that. We're going to continue to collect the fee because we want to. Now, who's creating the mayhem here, right? How many times have we heard this threat to democracy term all the time, right? Well, this is a classic case of that, right? I don't care what the legislative branch says. I don't care that you're taking advantage of the school system. I don't care that you're making it harder for the school system to make ends meet and that we're sucking $6 million out of there and we've yet to walk into court and provide the statutory authority in order to do so. That is the classic definition of arbitrary and capricious. And they just don't care. So, you know, we'll spend thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars that we don't really have, right, litigating this matter because, as was pointed out in an article in NOLA.com by John Stanton today, and he said it well, whether there's a fight remains to be seen. Cantrell is not known for taking criticism or defeat well. And she and her aides have been increasingly willing to ignore any city ordinance the administration disagrees with, forcing the council or others to file suit to try and enforce the ordinances she finds objectionable. It's the same, you know, tactic that she takes when you, the public, say something that she doesn't like, right? She starts doing background checks on you and things of that nature and the whole deal. And, you know, it's everybody else's fault as to what's going on. And I mean, what's really been interesting over the weekend is we have Nagin taken up for Cantrell, right? And all of their problems are created by the media. Now, if that's not deflecting from the underlying human conduct that led to their indictments and conviction in one case and we're starting the process in the other, I don't know what is. Interestingly, tomorrow we're going to go through this with Rafi Goyeneche. We're going to talk a little bit about how the Nagin case came to be. And it might be the first time that this story is told. So stay tuned. It's going to be very interesting. You're going to want to hear this. And you're going to gain a better understanding that this person walked into a place of worship and is attempting to rewrite history and basically mislead the public about what the truth is. Mind-numbing. Unbelievable. Absolutely incredible. Say nothing. Stay wherever you are. If you can't be honest about what was happening, the lack of preparation, and everything else that goes along with that, I don't know what to tell you. So we'll see where this goes. There's a September 4th, I believe, date on this hearing, preliminary injunction hearing. And hopefully we can put this issue to rest once and for all. And hopefully maybe the mayor will succumb and eliminate this or negotiate a more appropriate fee than the fee that's being charged. It's pretty onerous. You know, and we're even having difficulty figuring out how much the revenue department budget is, how much of the money that they're taking from the school system makes up of the budget, so that we can try and put this in some context. You know, it's been kind of a guessing game, and the finance director, Romy Schofield Samuel, doesn't really offer up a whole lot. No big surprise there, because I don't think she has a leg to stand on. But here we are again. We're going to end up fighting about things that we don't really need to fight about and should be pretty easy to resolve. And this is why the city council finds itself having to step in order to attempt to try and do the right thing more often than not, right? They have a lot of other things they would love to be able to address and take care of and look into and the whole nine yards. But no, we've got this sideshow that goes on all the time. Much of it is very freakish in nature. We don't even know why we find ourselves in these positions, but we do, and it continues to be a huge distraction. I wanted to follow up on comments that I made yesterday about the 600,000 Chinese students that the president is now saying he intends to accept into the territorial boundaries of the United States, into our American colleges and universities. Now, what I didn't know at the time, and I know now, is that number, 600,000, is actually double the number of students that are currently here. Now, we had to listen a lot about homeland security, about the threat to the security of the homeland. We had to hear about laws that were passed in China that basically says that every person in China is a cudgel of the country, and you know they have to collect intelligence. It was called the National Intelligence Law, and it was passed in 2017. And Chinese citizens are required to support, assist, and cooperate with national intelligence efforts, regardless of their location. Doesn't matter where they are. They have this affirmative obligation. And you know what happens when they have access to this and others find out that they didn't share this with Big Daddy over there. They get in trouble. They got problems. Many go to jail. We also know that China really relies heavily on a lot of this non-traditional way of collecting intelligence. We had to hear about all of this, testified to by national security officials, testified to by FBI directors, pontificated on by President Trump and his minions over and over and over again. So now that we have had some, I guess, nice communications with China, everything's changed. And yesterday, in that same cabinet meeting, the president began to outline how we're going to get along with the Chinese. And it's just going to have to happen. And we're going to do this. And my suspicion is that maybe he recognizes and realizes that we're not going to be able to stay on the path that we're on for much longer, because some of the economic data is beginning to reveal itself, and it is very fluid right now. And there's a lot of uncertainty as in to what direction it's going to go in. And it's interesting. So 600,000. But what you need to know is that our all-time high of foreign students here was about 1.1 million, right? Now, these are the numbers that are going to shock you. Some universities have extraordinarily high enrollments of foreign students. For example, Columbia University and Northeastern University have student bodies that are 40% foreign students. 40%. 4 out of 10 students there are here on a student visa. Carnegie Mellon has 44% foreign students. Illinois Tech is 51% foreign students. And the big issue for me and the friction point is that whatever happened with President Trump's notion of America first? We have a lot of our kids that would love to go to these universities, but obviously there's not enough capacity. The enrollment, the acceptance rate in some of these universities is single digit. Single digit, but 40% are foreign students. See, they take those out of those numbers, right? They're paying full freight. So this is a financial thing, and it's so much so. And you know that there hasn't been the warmest and fuzziest relationship between the president and these universities. The president said yesterday that if we didn't change this, these schools would go under. If we didn't change this, he said the enrollment cliff that arrives over the next 2 years, it's going to be bad for these schools. They're going under. Now, this is a hell of a thing. We have been investing in these schools and these universities and higher ed in a huge way. We have engaged in exotic financing schemes there, utilizing your tax dollars, and many of you paying this to schools that your kids will never go to. We have developed infrastructure on these universities, and we're sharing the wealth in huge numbers with foreign students. But be that as it may, they have been contributing some dollars as well because they're paying full freight, right? So the ROI, quite frankly, for these universities is far greater to have these foreign students there. But when does it become really a situation where it's harming the ability and the upward mobility of our kids to get into some of these high-performing schools? It's not like we don't have kids that have the grades. We hear stories all the time of students with 4.3, 4.4, 4.5 GPA and a 36 on the ACT. A perfect score. And guess what happens? They don't get in. And then we get the diversity excuse. This is why they're not getting in. No, 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 no. I think it's because we're selling all of these spots, for the most part, to these foreign students. 1.1, 1.2 million worth of these foreign students. And now they want to raise the numbers even higher. Really? I've yet to hear from anyone say, how does that truly inure to our benefit? And what happened to all of these arguments that we talked about for the last 6 months? A couple of fuzzy, nice little conversations with Xi Jinping, and all of a sudden this whole thing changes? The dialogue changed? The paradigm changes? Everything? They promised that they were going to improve their behavior, and now we've taken them off a double secret probation and given them another chance and given them more opportunity to collect more intelligence by doubling the number of Chinese students that are here. Call your Congress folks, call your senators, call your House members, if you feel like I feel. Don't sell us a pig in a poke. Don't have us go down this pathway and then all of a sudden pull the rug out from everyone saying, never mind, don't believe a word I said 6 months ago, 5 months ago. Don't believe what I've been saying about what I have to do. It's actually the opposite, and we're going to double down. I don't know about you. I don't like it. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Bo Jones, president and CEO of the Water Institute. Bo, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Noel.
So, Bo, your organization was kind of an outgrowth or in the aftermath of Katrina, right? And if you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, talk about the mission and vision of the Water Institute.
Yeah, absolutely, Noel. You know, I think the easiest way to connect this is to connect the dots to what you were saying yesterday, where you were with Ms. Barnes talking about how, look, you're kind of tired of talking about resilience, as it always seems, you know, that it's a struggle to survive rather than how are we pushing forward. So after Hurricane Katrina and Rita, many in Louisiana, New Orleans, and elsewhere, Baton Rouge, had that same idea, is that rather than just bouncing back, which are amazing at bouncing back, and you've had some great stories on this week about people bouncing back. The idea was, how do we take these incredibly tough life experiences and this existence on a dynamic delta and use it as an opportunity to create excellence in how we plan, how we build, how we connect. So the Institute is an applied research organization that spun out of that idea in 2005. Been around for about 15 years, and our mission is the vulnerability of people, communities, ecosystems, and communities. And so that's what we've been trying to do for the last 15 years, kind of get started after Katrina.
So if you would, I know you guys have involved yourself in a number of different projects and things of that nature. Tell us about some that you see as emblematic of this forward movement.
Yeah, I think there's the work that we're doing, which I'm super proud of and happy to talk about. But I think one of the things that's important to note is that the Water Institute is one of many organizations, both in the academic research community, the private sector, architecture community, and the nonprofit sector, that since Katrina has not only been pushing back against the problem, but they're trying to figure out how we can help help communities around the Gulf Coast and around the country get to that point a little quicker. So a couple examples, you know, we have had the privilege since 2012 of working on the state's comprehensive coastal master plan, hand in glove with three state administrations now working to help have these comprehensive flood protection, ecosystem restoration services. Today, I'm proud to be a part of the state's hurricane flood forecasting and decision-making system. So with your background, Newell, as a sheriff, you know, one of the things we're doing is working with the Governor's Office of Homeland Security and the local officials to try and not just predict when storms are coming, but then make decisions based upon that. What roads are going to flood? Where do we have search and rescue needs? Where are critical facilities going to be impacted? So we're working with the state there. but then also expanding out from Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, you know, we have been pulled in with partners to communities, Houston, Mobile, Jacksonville, St. Pete, all trying to learn at a faster clip the lessons that have been learned here in Louisiana. But then in so doing, we go to those communities and we learn wonderful things about what they're doing and what they're focusing on, and we bring those back home.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, every time we hit a hurricane season, it's kind of a live science project, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that even in our lifetime, Newell, right, you know, we all in this region, the white knuckles come out in June, and we start in the tropics. And one of the things, you know, regardless of how you shape it and how you shape it, one of the things that we've learned, Katrina wasn't the first example, it won't be the last. Of our limited ability to look backwards and say, this is what's going to happen in the future. We try. You know, there's wonderful models, wonderful scientists, and wonderful teams looking at the historic data to try and predict what's going to happen in the future. But there are so many factors, so much uncertainty, right? We don't know where there's going to be power to the pump. We don't know what human challenges are going to happen. And so we have to be prepared for things that we expect.
Give me a call back.
Bo, I think what we're going to do is we're going to go to a break. We've got a connection problem here because we keep losing you. We'll be right back. We're visiting with Bo Jones, President and CEO of the Water Institute. Stay with us, folks. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Bo Jones, President and CEO of the Water Institute. Bo, I wanted to cover one thing. You guys have launched a community resilience center. And you address many different issues, but most importantly, I think the top of mind issue right now, and you know this better than most, is that it's all about insurance, right? Flood insurance, homeowners insurance. And I think you guys have kicked off some pilot projects to kind of test innovative insurance solutions here in Louisiana. Tell us about them.
Absolutely, Newell, and great to be back on a good line. Sorry for the breaking up before. Exactly right. You know, we got our start working on a lot of those coastal restoration issues, right? But one of the things that we saw and many people in the region saw is that, you know, it may be the storm that runs somebody away. It may be a storm that pushes you from your home. But oftentimes it's the financials. Oftentimes it's not being able to get a job. It's your market crashing. It's, you know, not being able to insure your home, having to raise your home 25 feet. So some of these more economic considerations are there. So with the support of the federal government and local community foundations and a series of partners, we launched the Community Resilience Center. And the idea is to go directly into communities, whether it's the United Home of Nation down the bayou, whether it is communities on the Gulf Coast, to try and meet them where they are to say, what is the next step? And one of the things that they have almost resoundingly said is insurance, insurance, insurance. So we are working on several pilot projects that both look at the existing system of risk rating 2.0 of how can you live within the system that exists? How can you make it better? How can you use the incredible data? And Newell, it's important to point out that there is no state in the country that has a better understanding and data set of its risk and its activities to combat that risk in Louisiana. And so how can we use that data to improve people's abilities to live here economically? And then the second piece is, in the situations where the standard insurance doesn't work, can we explore new ideas like parametric insurance or catastrophe-based insurance? And we're working actually in Franklin, Louisiana, along the Bayou Teche with the communities there to see if we can have the insurance companies and the partners, the community partners, pilot some new ideas around how to make sure that people can feel safe and economically comfortable living where we do, but also recognizing the risk. And so there's some really exciting studies that are happening, and there's just an incredible resounding concern and interest from at the community scale, right, from the block by block, to figure out how they can remain in this place that you know, many of us call home and intend to do so for many generations to come.
Well, we hear a lot of conversations about, you know, the 100-year storm protection. And you talk about this data that y'all have collected, and I know that you know a lot about this. What does that actually mean? And can we take that information and kind of transpose that to the protection that we might have from what category type of storm?
Yeah.
Is that out there?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. But, this, I think, is one of the most critical advancements for our community since Hurricane Katrina, which is that the 100-year storm, or translated, is a 1% chance of a storm happening any given year, right? So in the last 20 years, there's a 20% chance that we would have had a 100-year storm, right? So it's an odd number and an odd way to classify things. But previously, the hurricane protection in the New Orleans region was based upon these model storms. We're going to protect from a 100-year storm, et cetera, et cetera. What you have seen, and it's a big acronym, the HSDRS, the Hurricane Storm Surge, the Damage Risk Reduction System, the HSDRS system, which is the system all around Orleans, St. Bernard, and Jefferson. And that system now says, look, we're not going to tell you a Cat 1, a Cat 2, a Cat 3, a 100-year, a 500-year storm. It's not going to be based on that. What we're going to do is we're going to try and reduce risk under all those storms. And that's important to communicate and understand, because when you, if you plan for a Cat 3 storm, you get a Cat 4 storm, and you didn't make plans for a Cat 4 storm, well, then planning's out the window. But if you plan for failure, and if you plan for overtopping, if you plan for what you did not expect, then you build systems like the system we are building here, the $14 billion system in and around New Orleans, that at times is allowed to be overtopped, and there's armoring on the backside. We understand that we can't use these hypothetical predictions of a 100-year storm or 500-year storm only to predict what's going to happen in the future. So Colonel Otan, the new commander of the Mississippi of the New Orleans District of the Army Corps, gave a beautiful rendition of this at the recent coastal meeting of the advancement that's been made. Now, it's not perfect, right? There's still risk, and that is important to communicate. But if we know that risk is there and plan for it, we're safer, and we're more honest about what we can protect and what we cannot.
I think it's safe to say that Mother Nature is predictably unpredictable, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, because when you think about path of storm and 1 degree left, 1 degree right, and how much of a huge differential that may be, it almost gets to the point of being a little bit silly how all of, the confluence of all those factors could be a differential of 20 to 30% in intensity of the storm or impact of the storm, which those things are not necessarily synonymous, right?
Exactly. I mean, what you're hitting at, right, is that, in science and in policy, right, we like certainty. We like to be able to tell people things with a certain level of conviction. But as you get into this situation with Mother Nature and with storms, we have to be very honest with the uncertainty that exists. And when you take, as you pointed out, the dynamism of a hurricane, then overlay that with our system, right? Our roads, how many Mardi Gras beads are in a storm drain? Is this pump operating? Is this flood wall closed? All of those uncertainties. Well, what I often say is, kind of the fish swallows the whale, right? The uncertainty swallows the certainty. So when we accept that, we have to plan differently. We have to plan not with this idea that we are all knowing and can show exactly what's going to happen. We have to tell the public, we have to tell ourselves, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but here are the probabilistic scenarios. Here's what we think may happen. And if we do, this is what, if that happens, this is what we plan to do. And so there's actually been some wonderful advancements, not just with our organization, by any doubt, by the local governments, the state governments, to rethinking the way, if we can't change the certainty, if we don't know what Mother Nature is going to do, if we don't know all of the factors, well, let's change the way we plan.
No, absolutely. Bo Jones, as always, truly appreciate the conversation. We'll get you back on soon, because there's a lot more that I'd like to talk to. Talk with you about Bo Jones, President and CEO of the Water Institute. Thank you so much for joining us today. And
anytime.
Have a
Thank
great
you,
Labor Day.
Yeah, you
Thank
as well.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Jefferson Parish Sheriff Joe Lapinto, and we'll be talking about his deployment of first responder drones that are set to take place in the month of September. Where do you hear about this technology? We'll also visit with Philip May, President and CEO of Entergy Louisiana. We'll talk about the Louisiana Public Service Commission's approval of their plan to build new infrastructure to support Meta's $10 billion data center.